Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Please support our independent journalism at democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar. Thank you so much. New York, this is Democracy Now!
The army is everywhere, in many houses. They burnt cars and destroyed them. They burnt houses. The army is present in every empty house. I left my home and they were still there. I was hardly able to pick clothes for my daughter.
As the death toll in Gaza nears 19,000, the Israeli military is also carrying out deadly raids inside the occupied West Bank. We'll go to Jenin to speak to the artistic director of the Freedom Theater, who was jailed this week after Israel rounded up hundreds of Palestinian men. Two of his colleagues remain in detention. He'll speak to us from the theater, which was trashed by Israeli forces. We'll also speak to Peter Schumann, the 89-year-old co-founder of Bread and Puppet Theater, about how his legendary troupe is addressing Israel's assault on Gaza.
What could be worse, a worse violation of our human rights than bombing hospitals and then send the murderers to investigate the crime?
But first, we speak to the acclaimed writer Masha Gessen, who is scheduled to receive the prestigious Hannah Arendt Prize in Germany today. But the ceremony was postponed after a major German foundation withdrew its support for the award after Gessen compared life in Gaza to the Warsaw Ghetto. We'll also speak to Masha Gessen about being placed on Russia's most wanted list for comments they made about the war in Ukraine. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the Gaza Strip, at least 33 people were killed when Israel's military struck a UN school in Khan Yunis, being used as a shelter of last resort for Palestinians expelled from their homes. Israeli raids also killed and wounded Palestinians at hospitals in Deir al-Balah, Khan Yunis, and in Gaza's southernmost city of Rafah, where more than a million displaced Palestinians are sheltering. Abu Mohammed Klab was one of those gathered at the morgue in Rafah's Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital Thursday. They'd come to collect the bodies of loved ones killed by Israeli strikes.
They are looking at the images, but no one is saying anything. The dead are all children, women, and old people. They are not from the resistance. They are all civilians. You know the numbers of civilians, so why are you still silent? How long will you stay silent? Enough. Enough with this life.
The death toll from Israel's assaults on Gaza and the West Bank since October is nearing 19,000. More than a third of those killed are children. An estimated 50,000 Palestinians have been injured. On Thursday, Israel once again cut phone and internet service across most of Gaza, further hampering relief efforts. The World Food Program reports half of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people is starving, while 9 out of 10 people are not eating enough and don't know where their next meal will come from. On Thursday, Philippe Lazzarini, the head of the UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees, said it's become almost impossible to distribute the small amount of aid Israel's allowing into Gaza.
People are stopping aid trucks, taking the food and eating it right away. And this is how desperate and hungry they are. And I witness this firsthand.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed an unarmed 17-year-old boy inside the Khalil Suleiman Hospital. Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, also witnessed Israeli soldiers blocking medical workers and ambulances carrying discharge patients home. Drivers were forced to get out of their vehicles, strip down, kneel in the streets. MSF says it's part of a pattern targeting healthcare workers in the West Bank since October 7th, which also has included shooting live fire and tear gas at hospitals, blocking emergency vehicles, and humiliating and harassing medical staff. Outside the hospital compound, Israeli soldiers desecrated a mosque in Jenin and read out Jewish prayers in the style of an Islamic call to prayer. This came as part of a three-day Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp, the largest in 20 years, which killed at least 12 Palestinians. Israeli forces arrested over 100 others. President Joe Biden said Thursday Israel's military should be, quote, more careful to save Palestinian civilian lives. His comments came as U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet in Tel Aviv. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant told Sullivan Israel's campaign in Gaza will continue well into 2024.
It will take and require a long period of time.
It will last more than several months, but we will win and we will destroy them.
According to the White House, Sullivan told Israeli leaders the U.S. expects Israel's military to soon switch to, quote, lower intensity operations. The White House did not give a timeline for the change, but the New York Times cites four unnamed U.S. officials who said Biden wants to grant Israel 3 weeks to switch to, quote, more precise tactics. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera has obtained an advance copy of a United Nations report detailing the devastating impact of Israel's assault on Gaza. In it, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemns Israeli airstrikes on protected persons, including journalists, health workers, and UN personnel, pleading with the Security Council to approve a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. Guterres writes, quote, "The magnitude of Israel's military campaign against Hamas and the scope of death and destruction in Gaza has been unprecedented and unbearable to witness," unquote. Jewish-led protests Thursday shut down bridges and highways across eight U.S. cities demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. The peaceful actions in Seattle, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Portland, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Minneapolis, and Atlanta came on the eighth and final day of Hanukkah. In Portland, protesters blocked the Burnside Bridge as they held a homemade 9-foot menorah and sang Hanukkah songs and prayers.
As Jews, we come from long legacies of resistance and resilience. Rededication is a theme of Hanukkah. So on this last night, we rededicate our lineage of resilience towards the struggle against genocide, against apartheid, against occupation.
That protest in Oregon. On Capitol Hill, labor leaders joined progressive Congress members at a rally Thursday demanding President Biden support an immediate ceasefire and allow urgent humanitarian aid, food, and water into Gaza. United Auto Workers President Sean Fain spoke alongside Congress members Cori Bush and Rashida Tlaib.
The world's seen enough slaughter and devastation. Peace is the only path forward. While we call for a ceasefire, we also condemn anti-Semitism,
that's right.
Yeah. Islamophobia,
that's right.
Anti-Arab racism,
that's right.
All of which are growing in our nation at this moment and must be stopped.
Leaders of the Postal Workers Union and the United Electrical, Radio and Machine Workers of America are also calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Biden administration staffers and other U.S. government employees are continuing to demand a permanent ceasefire. Dozens gathered for a vigil outside the White House Wednesday. Staffers concealed their identities with sunglasses and face masks as they read the names of some of the thousands of Palestinians killed in Gaza. The House of Representatives voted 310 to 118 to pass a record $886 billion military bill Thursday, one day after it won Senate approval. Its passage came despite concerns over its extension of Section 702 of FISA, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which allows for warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens. The Congressional Progressive Caucus encouraged its members to oppose the measure, though in the end, just 45 Democrats voted against the largest ever National Defense Authorization Act. The ACLU said, quote, it's incredibly disheartening that Congress decided to extend an easily abused law with zero of the reforms needed to protect all of our privacy, they said. The bill also includes more military funding for Ukraine, a 5.2% raise for troops, and a measure preventing the president from withdrawing from NATO without congressional approval. The UN's World Food Program reports nearly 50 million people across Western and Central Africa are expected to go hungry next year, warning international funding for humanitarian aid is failing to keep pace with record levels of acute hunger. An analysis published by the WFP this week found more than two-thirds of households in the region cannot afford healthy diets due to a combination of conflict, climate change, and soaring food prices. Alo Sib is the World Food Program's head of research for Western and Central Africa.
Nearly 80% of the people currently facing food insecurity are located in conflict zones. We also witnessed the impacts of climate change. For instance, this year, there have been prolonged periods of halted rainfall in certain areas, resulting in significant crop losses for local farmers.
The UN is warning hunger in Sudan's conflict zones is headed toward famine-like conditions, as some Khartoum residents have been surviving on a single small daily meal. Some 30 million people, roughly two-thirds of the population, are in need of assistance in Sudan, according to the UN. That's double the number before fighting broke out in April between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces. The violence and economic woes have devastated Sudan's agricultural sector, which has also been hit by below-average rains. Meanwhile, residents of the city of Omdurman, which lies on the west bank of the Nile River, accused Sudanese soldiers of looting and shooting civilians in the Ambada district, the only area of the city still controlled by government forces. The RSF has also been accused of looting in areas under its control. A court in Senegal has ordered jailed opposition leader Ousmane Sonko to be reinstated on the electoral roll, paving the way for him to stand in next year's presidential election. Sonko, who's expected to be a key challenger of President Macky Sall, was sentenced in June to a two-year prison term over an alleged sexual assault, charges he's accused the government of manufacturing to derail his candidacy. In late July, Senegalese officials dissolved Sonko's Patriots of Senegal party, the first time a political party has been banned in the West African nation since its independence from France in 1960. The European Union's agreed to open membership talks with Ukraine and Moldova. Leaders of 26 EU member states unanimously approved the accession talks Thursday after Hungary's far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orban left the room just before votes were cast. Orban, who is widely viewed as an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin, had threatened to veto Ukraine's bid to join the EU. He appeared to back down after European leaders released more than $10 billion worth of aid to Hungary it had withheld after determining Orban's nationalist government was failing to uphold the rule of law. Meanwhile, Hungary's government blocked a European Union financial aid package for Ukraine worth $55 billion. Talks on that package will resume next year. And Brazilian lawmakers have approved a law making it harder for indigenous communities to make claims over ancestral territory. The law, which overrides a veto by President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, says such claims are not valid unless indigenous groups physically occupied the land when the 1988 Brazilian Constitution was signed. Many indigenous communities were expelled from their lands over the course of decades, including during the military dictatorship. The measure comes in the wake of a September Supreme Court ruling, which rejected the 1988 timeline for indigenous territorial claims. The new law, backed by powerful agribusiness interests, threatens to open vast portions of indigenous territory to logging, mining, farming, and ranching. Congressmember Celia Chacabria was among the minority of lawmakers who voted against the legislation.
The defeat is not only for us, the indigenous people. The defeat is for the climate agenda. We, the indigenous people, have been the number one solution to stop the climate crisis. And today, the Congress responded, throwing the solution away.
Celia Chakriaba was sitting next to Sonia Guajajara, the first indigenous minister of Brazil. We'll be bringing you an exclusive interview with her next week. Brazil's Supreme Court is expected to now review whether the new law is constitutional. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, the acclaimed writer Masha Gessen, who was scheduled to receive the prestigious Hannah Arendt Prize in Germany today, but the ceremony was postponed after a major German foundation withdrew its support for the award, after Gessen compared life in Gaza to the Warsaw Ghetto. Stay with us.
زوايا بالشارع مش مادة مونتاج باستوديو اجانب انا بس حقيق مباشر مش متعلق بل انا معلق بل انا محلل مش متعلق
Street Poetry by Dom. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with the acclaimed Russian-American writer Masha Gessen, scheduled to receive the prestigious Hannah Arendt Prize in Germany today. But the ceremony had to be postponed after one of the award's sponsors, the left-leaning Heinrich Böll Foundation, withdrew its support for the prize after Masha Gessen compared Gaza to the Warsaw Ghetto in a recent article for The New Yorker titled, In the Shadow of the Holocaust, How the Politics of Memory in Europe Obscures What We See in Israel and Gaza Today. The German city of Bremen also withdrew the venue where today's prize ceremony was scheduled to take place. In the essay, Masha Gessen wrote, quote, For the last 17 years, Gaza has been a hyper-densely populated, impoverished, walled-in compound where only a small fraction of the population had the right to leave for even a short amount of time. In other words, a ghetto. Not like the Jewish ghetto in Venice or an inner-city ghetto in America, but like a Jewish ghetto in an Eastern European country occupied by Nazi Germany. Masha Gessen went on to write about why the term ghetto is not commonly used to describe Gaza. They wrote, quote, presumably, the more fitting term ghetto would have drawn fire for comparing the predicament of besieged Gazans to that of ghettoized Jews. It also would have given us the language to describe what's happening in Gaza now. The ghetto is being liquidated. Masha Gessen's essay sparked some outrage in Germany, and its announcement withdrawing support for Gessen's prize, the Heinrich Böll Foundation, which is tied to the German Green Party, criticizes Gessen's essay, saying it, quote, implies that Israel aims to liquidate Gaza like a Nazi ghetto, unquote. While the foundation pulled out of the Hannah Arendt Prize ceremony, a smaller ceremony will take place Saturday at a different venue. For Gessen, the controversy in Germany comes just days after being added to Russia's most wanted list for comments they made about the war in Iraq, in Ukraine. Masha Gessen joins us now from Bremen, Germany. Masha Gessen is staff writer at The New Yorker, author of numerous books, including most recently Surviving Autocracy. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Masha. If you can start off by talking about this controversy, talking about what you wrote in The New Yorker magazine and the fact that, well, the ceremony hasn't been completely canceled, but just explain what's happened.
Hi, Amy. It's good to be here. I don't know that I can fully explain what happened because I don't think I quite understand what happened, because the Heinrich Böll Foundation first withdrew from the prize ceremony, causing the city of Bremen to withdraw from the prize ceremony, causing the prize organizers to tell me that, first of all, they stand by me and by their decision to give me the prize, but also to, and then the university where the discussion the day after the prize was supposed to be held also withdrew. And this is interesting because the university said that they believed that having the discussion would violate a law. Now, by the law, I think what they actually meant was the non-binding resolution that bans anything connected with the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, which is non-binding but has a huge influence in Germany. And that was largely the topic of my article. So then the prize organizers decided to have a smaller ceremony at a different location, which I'm not going to mention, not because I'm afraid of Germans, but because I'm concerned about Russians. And then the Heinrich Böll Foundation, after quite an uproar in German social media and conventional media, issued a new statement saying that they stand by the prize, but the venue had canceled, so they couldn't hold this award ceremony, so it was postponed, which I don't think was entirely forthcoming on the part of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, and their first statement was on record. But that's where we stand now.
So let's talk about the heart of what the Heinrich Böll Foundation has found so controversial. Talk about this piece that you wrote for The New Yorker magazine, the comparison you've made to Gaza and the Warsaw Ghetto.
So the piece is fairly wide-ranging. It's a piece in which I traveled through Germany, Poland, and Ukraine and talk about the politics of memory in each country. But a large part of the piece and how we view the current war in Israel-Palestine through the prism or fail to view the war through the prism of the Holocaust. A large part of the article is devoted to, in fact, memory politics in Germany and the vast anti-Semitism machine, which largely targets people who are critical of Israel and, in fact, are often Jewish. This happens to be a description that fits me as well. I am Jewish. I come from a family that includes Holocaust survivors. I grew up in the Soviet Union, very much in the shadow of the Holocaust. That's where the phrase in the headline came from, is from the passage in the article itself. And I am critical of Israel. Now, the part that really offended the Heinrich Böll Foundation and the city of Bremen, and I would imagine some German public, is the part that you read out loud, which is where I make the comparison between the besieged Gaza, so Gaza before October 7th, and a Jewish ghetto in Nazi-occupied Europe. I made that comparison intentionally. It was not a what they call here a provocation. It was very much the point of the piece, because I think that the way that memory politics function now in Europe and in the United States, but particularly in Germany, is that their cornerstone is that you can't compare the Holocaust to anything. It is a singular event that stands outside of history. My argument is that in order to learn from history, we have to compare. Like, that actually has to be a constant exercise. We are not better people or smarter people or more educated people than the people who lived 90 years ago. The only thing that makes us different from those people is that in their imagination, the Holocaust didn't yet exist, and in ours, it does. We know that it's possible. And the way to prevent it is to be vigilant in the way that Hannah Arendt, in fact, and other Jewish thinkers who survived the Holocaust were vigilant and were, there was an entire conversation, especially in the first two decades after World War II, in which they really talked about how to recognize the signs of sliding into the darkness. And I think that we need to, oh, and one other thing that I want to say is that our entire framework of international humanitarian law is essentially based, it all comes out of the Holocaust, as does the concept of genocide. And I argue that that framework is based on the assumption that you're always looking at war, at conflict, at violence through the prism of the Holocaust. You always have to be asking the question of whether crimes against humanity, the definitions of which came out of the Holocaust, are recurring. And Israel has waged an incredibly successful campaign at setting its, not only setting the Holocaust outside of history, but setting itself aside from the optics of international humanitarian law, in part by weaponizing the politics of memory, the politics of the Holocaust.
So talk more about that, that learning about the Holocaust through the idea that it is separate and apart and can be compared to nothing else versus how we ensure never again, anywhere, for anyone.
I don't know that we can ensure it never again, anywhere, for anyone, but I think the only way to try to ensure it is to keep knowing that the Holocaust is possible. Keep knowing that it can come out of what Aaron called shallowness. I mean, this was very much her point in Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report in the banality of evil. And by the way, this was a book that got Arendt really ostracized by both the Israeli political mainstream and much of the North American Jewish political mainstream for things that she wrote about the Judenrat, but also for this very framing of the banality of evil. It was misinterpreted as trivializing the Holocaust. But what she was saying is that the most horrible things of which humanity has proven capable can grow out of something that seems like nothing, can grow out of thoughtlessness, can grow out of the failure to see the fate of the other, or the inability to see it. And I interpret that as a call to constant vigilance for failure to see the fate of the other, for doubting the kind of overwhelming consensus that certainly in Israel and in the North American Jewish community appears to back the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. This is the way in which we stumble into our darkest moments.
For people who don't know who Hannah Arendt is, the Jewish philosopher, political theorist, the author of The Origins of Totalitarianism and the Human Condition, The Banality of Evil as well, covered the Eichmann trial for the New Yorker magazine, the magazine that Masha Gessen writes for. Masha, last week, an Israeli airstrike in Gaza City killed the acclaimed Palestinian academic, the activist, the poet, Refat El-Arayr, along with his brother, his sister, and his four nieces. For more than 16 years, El-Arayr worked as a professor of English literature at the Islamic University of Gaza, where he taught Shakespeare and other subjects. The father of six, a mentor to so many young Palestinian writers and journalists, he co-founded the organization We're Not Numbers. In October, Democracy Now! Spoke to Refat El-Arayr, who also compared Gaza to the Warsaw Ghetto.
If you have seen the pictures from Gaza, we speak about complete devastation and destruction to universities, to schools, to mosques, to businesses, to clinics, to roads, infrastructure, to water lines. If I Googled this morning Warsaw Ghetto pictures, and I got pictures I couldn't differentiate. Somebody tweeted four pictures and asked to tell which one is from Gaza and which one is from the Warsaw Ghetto. They are remarkably the same because the perpetrator is almost using the same strategies against a minority, against the oppressed the people, the battered people, the besieged people, whether it was in a Warsaw Ghetto, the Jews in Warsaw Ghetto in the past, or Palestinian Muslims and Christians in the Gaza Strip. So the similarity is uncanny.
That was the Palestinian poet, writer, and professor Refat El-Arayr, who was killed in Gaza by an Israeli airstrike that killed his brother, sister, and four of her daughters. This is Scottish actor Brian Cox, famous for Succession, just nominated for a number of Emmys, reading Rifat Alarir's poem, If I Must Die, in a video that's gone viral.
If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite, you may.